Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. How does the human brain differ from the animal brain? What about our brain makes it unique in its ability to reason and problem solve? How do we know what we know, and how do we know that we really know it at all? What about the amazing phenomenon of irrational fear and anxiety? How does it come to be stuck in our heads despite our conscious knowledge that the thing we fear is often not really a threat at all? Ever wonder what happens to the brain when it experiences a physical trauma and how it can rewire itself to overcome these significant insults? Then there's the age-old question of what is normal aging of the brain and how much can we really do to preserve and improve its functioning in our later years? I invite you to stay with us over the next, say, 54 minutes or so as we explore these questions and more about this amazing organ we call the human brain. Joining me to discuss this topic is Anchorage neuropsychologist Dr. Paul Craig. Dr. Craig is a board-certified clinical neuropsychologist with over 25 years of experience in Alaska. Recognized for his excellence in the field, Dr. Craig has evaluated and or treated more than 10,000 patients with a broad array of known or suspected psychological or neuropsychological conditions. Dr. Craig is a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine and has served as an elected member of the Board of Directors of the American Psychological Association and the American Board of Clinical Neuropsychology. I want to thank you today for being here.
Thank you, Prentice. It's my pleasure.
Please remember, Line 1 is a live call-in show, so your calls and emails are encouraged and appreciated. We can be reached with your questions or comments, as always, in three ways. The local number, 550-8433, and toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell all that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. So if you've ever wondered about anything having to do with the brain, now is your chance to ask the expert. So don't hesitate to call in or email those questions. All right, Dr. Craig, I'd kind of like to just start off with the basics about something that I'm not, you know, I'm in the field and I'm not really all that sure about myself, which is, what does it mean to be a neuropsychologist? How is it different than psychology per se? What's unique about what you do?
Well, first of all, in terms of training to be a neuropsychologist, I am trained as a clinical psychologist generally, and then I'm specialty trained by way of a postdoctoral fellowship in clinical neuropsychology. So it's sort of like medicine, where all physicians are trained as MDs, and then they may go on to specialize beyond general medicine into a specialty field. In psychology, all clinical psychologists are trained as clinical psychologists, and some specialize in clinical neuropsychology, which is the study of brain-behavior relationships. So trying to understand how the brain itself affects behavior, emotions, thinking, performance.
It strikes me that that's sort of, that has to be where it all originates from, because it's all controlled by the brain. That's kind of what we're all doing.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of talk about the brain body as if they're two different things. But right. In fact, the brain is an organ of the body. And what's happening in the body has a huge influence on what's happening in the brain, and what's happening in the brain has a huge influence on what's happening in the body. So thinking of them about, you know, as if they're really distinct and separate entities is probably a mistake conceptually. They're deeply interrelated. But there's no question the brain is the heart, so to speak, of thinking. It's where feeling occurs. It's where what we call consciousness exists. Without the brain, none of the rest of it functions.
Right. It's just a heartbeat.
And not even that.
Right. At the base. Yeah. I mean, we have those base layer kind of reactions that are not controlled consciously, like heart rate and respiration and those things.
Correct.
All right. So neuropsychological testing versus psychological testing. I saw on your website that you do both psychological testing and neuropsych testing. What's the difference? What are you looking for that's unique in neuropsych testing versus psychological testing? Why would somebody pick one over the other?
Well, the two overlap to some degree. Psychological evaluation looks more at the emotional and behavioral aspects of how a person is functioning, either normally or abnormally. Thinking skills are sometimes included in a psychological evaluation, for example, intellectual testing. Neuropsychological testing includes those aspects of evaluation, but then goes much further into evaluating a variety of functions that are sensitive to how the brain is working. And those functions can go all the way down to very basic sensory and motor skills, all the way up to very high-level problem-solving, memory, sustained attention and concentration, very high-level thinking skills. So by way of assessing each one of those levels of thinking, we get to the point where we can draw some reasonable conclusions about how the brain is functioning.
Okay, so neuropsych testing is psychological testing plus, like a deeper level. It goes deeper into why we do what we do and how our brain works to do it.
I think that's generally speaking correct. However, I would also say that with psychological testing, there's sometimes additional issues and tests that are used that are far beyond or outside of neuropsychology. So the sort of circles that capture psychological testing and neuropsychological testing overlap, but psychological testing can have some unique instruments and techniques used that typically are not included in a neuropsychological evaluation.
All right. I've heard neuropsych testing was really for brain injuries, if there's a suspicion of an organic thing or some kind of, chronic concussions, a CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Did I get it?
You got it.
I nailed it, man, first time. And I won't say it again, CTE, right? That's what we can call it. All right. So I guess let's go into what makes us different. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, which goes way back into basic philosophy 101. And you mentioned consciousness earlier. Is it our consciousness, our awareness of our existence and ultimately our coming end, that we are uniquely aware in the animal kingdom that we are going to die? Is that what really makes our brain unique in the animal kingdom, or is it like more complicated than that?
Well, I like to say that, you know, if anybody ever tells you how the brain really works, hold them immediately suspect, but I will continue to tell you how the brain works.
Right. Okay.
So with regard to the uniqueness of the human brain, structurally, the one aspect of the human brain that's not found in any of the great apes or primates is the agranular frontal cortex.
Okay.
It's some tissue in the frontal lobes of the brain that is uniquely human and perhaps is an aspect of neuroanatomy and the structure and function of the brain that allows us to be human. I was once down at the aquarium in Vancouver, British Columbia, was watching the whales, and I turned around and I saw a display of a dolphin brain and was just amazed. That brain has more cortical surface area than the human brain by a long shot, is structurally much more complex than the human brain. So who knows what's going on in a dolphin brain? We really don't know. And we can't speak to their conscious experience. But with regard to human beings, we have the ability to conceive of our own demise, as you've already mentioned. And the truth is, none of us get out of this alive, at least alive as we know it.
Right.
And we all have to deal with that one way or the other. And I think our capacity to conceive of our own mortality, but also our capacity to think abstractly about the here and now, not just the future and not just the past, is uniquely human. Our capacity to use tools, our capacity to interface with our environment technologically, to do what we're doing right here, talking over the air. I don't know any other animals that can pull that off, but humans seem to have done it.
Maybe not just in a way that we understand it. I'm sure there's a lot of animal folks that would disagree with my assumption, and maybe and it is just an assumption, that we are the only creatures that are aware of our end, potentially. I mean, other animals grieve the loss of partners, or, you know, elephants are the great example, and whales too, like dolphins. You're right. That's pretty complex, but they can't talk to us about it, unfortunately.
We can ask animals questions, and they can give us answers. There's a whole field of psychology called comparative psychology that does that. But asking a question about its, you know, existential issues of an animal is a pretty tough question to ask.
Right. Yeah, how does an animal feel, and how does why does it do what it do? It does. I'm going to read something just quickly from the article, that which we have available on our website, alaskapublic.org. The article is called "Odds Are It's Wrong." It says that it's science's dirtiest little secret, that the scientific method of testing hypotheses by statistical analysis stands on a flimsy ground or foundation. Even when performed correctly, statistical tests are widely misunderstood and frequently misinterpreted. As a result, countless of conclusions in the scientific literature are erroneous, and tests of medical dangers or treatments are often contradictory and confusing. As you said earlier, follow those who seek the truth and run from those who have found it. That's Voltaire, right? Or somebody. It's been attributed to quite a few people. But yeah, can you speak to that article and what that means, that science is not really knowing, and the idea that we really may be wrong about a lot of what we think we know?
Right. So a very important article published regarding this very topic was published by a Greek epidemiologist, Ioannidis, in 2005. And it's just, it's an iconoclastic article. It just sort of blew up a lot of what everybody assumes to be true. And it's one of those things that scientists don't like to think about. But in fact, statistics are the tool of science. And around the 1920s, statistics and scientific inquiry started to get married, and they've developed a closer and closer relationship over time. And statistics is the tool that is used by scientists to determine whether there is or is not a significant relationship, and frequently a causal relationship, between two variables. What Ioannidis talked about is the fact that given the biases inherent to scientific research, and given the shortcomings of statistics, that much of what we presume to be true may not in fact be true. I'm a scientist. I love the scientific method, but I'm also a skeptic by nature. I like to always question anything, even the stuff that we believe to be true based upon science. And what I like to say is that science is not the truth, with a capital T. It's a collection of probabilistic statements that seems to be supported by the data that we have available to us today.
Meaning if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it might be a duck?
Yeah. And a friend of mine, a neuropsychologist from the L.A. area, Dr. Leah Ellenberg, she studied with a Nobel Prize winner back when she was in graduate school. I believe it was Michael Gazzaniga who got the Nobel Prize for the split brain research.
Right.
And his statement to her was, if you need statistics to prove your point, it's probably a not a very important point. And You know, on the other hand, statistics are a valuable tool. I don't want to criticize the use of statistics, but I also think that we need to be really careful. I'll just give you a real quick example. Let's say that you have a test, a blood test, that is used to determine whether an athlete has or has not used steroids. And you've got 400 athletes you're going to test, and you have 20 who are using steroids, mm-hmm. 380 who are not. I'm just giving you a hypothetical case. And let's just say that your test has a 5% false positive, false negative base rate. Okay, so 1 out of 20 times, it's wrong. So you're going to test all 400 athletes. The base rates, again, the actual base rates are 20 versus 380 who don't. So now you test the 20, and 1 out of 20 are wrong. So you get 19 that show up positive, 1 that doesn't. Slips through the test because of the false negative. Now you take the other 380 and you give them the test, and 5% of them, 1 out of 20, show up positive by way of error. And now you have 19 positives that aren't using steroids. So now you have 38 individuals who have been identified positively. And you started all this out knowing scientifically that your test had a 5% error rate, but all of a sudden you've discovered that half of your positive sample actually is abusing steroids and half isn't. That's a hypothetical example, mm-hmm. but the point is, when you start teasing out the nuances of base rates and statistical approaches to science, you start realizing there are some shortcomings that need to be attended to.
All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Anchorage neuropsychologist Dr. Paul Craig, and we are discussing the human brain with a particular focus on some of the things that can go wrong, how to keep yours in top operational condition. So you can reach us with your questions or comments as in the normal three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free from anywhere in the state at 1-888, or I guess in the country for that matter, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. So speaking of an emailed question, I'm going to go ahead and read one here that was written in. How can you differentiate between bipolar 1 and schizoaffective disorder? Can you talk about the damage that occurs from untreated disorders such as deep depression in later teen years, which likely fully manifested into bipolar? Have you seen that as the prefrontal cortex matures through the early 20s, that individuals with bipolar 1 and these other serious brain disorders calm down? That's a tough question. Differentiate between bipolar and schizoaffective disorders?
I think I almost put people to sleep talking about statistics.
Right. So this cranks it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Now we're talking bipolar.
Yeah. In any case, I don't have a specific answer off the cuff to that question. There is a growing body of neuropsychological literature regarding both bipolar disorder, and schizoaffective disorder, as mm-hmm. well as schizophrenia, and what happens from a neuropsychological perspective in the context of onset of these conditions. With regard to the sort of trajectory and the longitudinal question being asked, what happens over time? As it turns out, that's a hard question to answer because most research projects are funded for 3 years, sometimes 5 years. So really understanding from a scientific perspective over time is challenging, because a lot of these studies are just looking at a cross-section at any particular time. But I would just in general say that there is an increasing body of literature about major psychiatric disorders that were presumed to be lifelong, never changing, like schizophrenia.
Right.
That once you had it forever. And there's some good evidence that many people who carried a diagnosis of schizophrenia have been able to sort of reconstitute and move beyond the diagnosis and lead a fairly normal life. Similarly, with bipolar disorder, there are some people who do sort of mellow out with aging, and there are other people who do require ongoing management of bipolar disorder throughout the remainder of their adulthood. From a neuropsychological perspective, it'd be a bit presumptuous of me to try to fully answer the question.
I had Robert Rhodes on the show a couple of times, and he's a therapist here in town who I have a lot of respect for. And one of the things that he said, and I have seen it in my own practice, is that so many of these kids that were going through North Star, I'll say North Star because they're gone now, back in the day, or was it? No, it was Charter.
Charter.
Yeah, Charter. Charter.
North Star does exist.
North Star is now. But, you know, it seemed like 10, 15 years ago, there was all this bipolar coming out. And lots of teenagers and young adults with bipolar disorder, and then we wouldn't see them for several years, and they would come back in as young adults, and you'd say, well, so how's that bipolar thing going? How's that cocktail that you were on? And say, oh, I haven't taken that for years. And, you know, and I don't see any evidence of bipolar. I think there is so much overlap in the symptomology. You were talking earlier about how we know what we know, and I think in psychology and making diagnoses, it's really hard in teenagers and young adults to know what we know.
I would agree with that. And even in medicine, we like to think that when we go to the doctor and get a laboratory test performed and get results and are either diagnosed with or without a particular condition, that that's black and white and accurate. And there's a lot of data regarding that issue, and there's false positives, false negatives in medical tests, and certainly with psychiatric and psychological diagnoses, there are false positives and false negatives.
And you have to consider other factors such as substance abuse when you're talking about schizoaffective disorders and bipolar, because that can, long-term substance abuse can mimic, you know, like some of the mood swings and the ups and downs and the acting out behavior. Impulsivity and all that stuff that gets misdiagnosed as bipolar. So I always want people to be really careful about getting stuck with labels, because I always think we're all humans being human, and none of us get through this without, you know, there's the diagnosed and the undiagnosed. Those are the two types of people.
And I'm with you with that. And I use those diagnoses extraordinarily conservatively.
Yes.
If you call somebody bipolar because they're a 14-year-old who's pretty active, you have just blocked their ability to ever have a pilot's license in the United States.
All right.
One diagnosis on one record, and never will that person function as a pilot if they're honest with regard to disclosing their medical records.
Yeah, there's military, there's law enforcement. These are all real concerns if you have a significant mental health diagnosis, such as bipolar as a teenager. It can stick.
When I think back to my own teenage years.
I've often said the definition of a 15-year-old girl is bipolar.
Yeah, like, well, and I was a boy.
And boys are, all over the place, too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move into, that was a great question. Thank you for that question. Let's move into the next area that kind of goes along with the depression, but on the other end, which is the anxiety. And one of the most fascinating areas of mental health for me is anxiety disorder and irrational fears. So one of the things I'd like for you to talk a little bit about is, like, how do anxiety disorders develop and how do they get sort of stuck in this circular pattern of being afraid of things that are often really not things that we should be afraid of necessarily?
Great question. And first of all, it's important to sort of define anxiety. And anxiety is the worry about what could be.
I call it anticipated suffering.
Exactly. Whereas fear is that emotional response that we get when there is an actual palpable threat in our environment.
Okay.
So I love to camp. If I go camping and I go to bed at night, I can have anxiety about a bear entering the camp area while I'm sleeping. If I hear the bear brushing up against my tent,
right.
I now am experiencing fear. And my dad used to always say, worry is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do, but gets you nowhere. And I like that. anxiety is one of those things that gets reinforced. It gets rewarded because the horrible thing frequently never happens. So you do all these avoidant behaviors, and nothing bad happens, and you discover that your ritual worked, your worry worked, your belief system worked. So one of the things that people can do to cope with anxiety is pick something that's not, you know, career breaker, and just let it slide and see what happens. Somebody who has a real concern about about a blanket being perfect on on their couch, let it stay wrinkled for the day. See what happens by the end of the day. Obviously, well, let me back up. Anxiety is not all bad. Anxiety is a really adaptive human characteristic. To the extent it helps us do the things that need to be done to prepare for the future. We're a pretty vulnerable critter. We don't have hair. We can't live in the cold. We need constant supply of food. So it's good to be a little anxious, to anticipate what's coming, to put away food, to put away wood or whatever fuel to burn. It makes us plan. And we have the brain capacity to plan and to work together collaboratively to make sure that our survival needs are met. And not just that higher level needs are met. And so anxiety is not bad, but when anxiety becomes severe, it can become debilitating and it can be paralyzing. And that's where people need to practice skills and techniques to reduce their anxiety.
All right. Well, that's a nice segue because that leads me right into my next question. Jack Nicklaus, the golfer, said concentration is a fine antidote to anxiety. And when I read that, it immediately popped into my mind. Isn't that really just mindfulness and like focusing on the task at hand and living as purely in the moment and dealing with what's right in front of you? Isn't that what he's talking about?
Well, I think that is what he's talking about, and I think he's talking about sinking a putt.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in life, everything's not about sinking a putt. There's other things that happen. So under the right circumstances, concentration is a wonderful tool to deal with anxiety. Actually doing something practical and concentrating on something practical that addresses whatever the topic is that you may have worries and fears about. There's other things that can be done. One is letting everything go from your mind, not concentrating, sort of meditating on as close as you can get to nothingness,
right.
Just letting it go and getting out in nature. For myself, I love going for a hike up in the Chugach Range in the summertime, and there's certain places I reach that look around, and for me, that's where I can let everything go. So we all have things we can do, activities we can be involved in that help us get outside ourselves and outside our worries. Another really good technique, especially this time of year, is focus on reaching out to somebody else, doing something, even if it's small, something kind, helpful, supportive of somebody else. That can help us quit worrying about ourselves and start paying attention to the people around us, the ones we love, as well as just strangers in the community.
So doing a good deed, doing some sort of service work, worrying about a friend's problems instead of your own. Exercise, a lot of people say when they get anxious, they need to go for a run or go ride in Kincaid.
All of those things are good. Sleep is a good thing. Exercise is a good thing. Eating healthy is a good thing.
What do you think therapy does for anxiety? What's the mechanism at work there?
Therapy in terms of psychotherapy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
talk therapy.
What I think is most important about therapy for people who are experiencing anxiety or depression or any other condition that could benefit from therapy is, first of all, developing an understanding about what they're experiencing and getting a model in their mind about why they're experiencing it. And then learning some strategies and techniques and practicing those techniques to change the way they're feeling. And I'm not a believer in, world is getting better and better every day in every way. It's not. But I am a believer in what I call realistic thinking. And by paying attention to what's really happening all-inclusively around you, there's certain things that make sense to cry about. There's certain things that make sense to be fearful about. But there's a lot of things to be thankful for, to enjoy, to embrace. And therapy helps a person, I think, get a realistic perspective about themselves, their situation, their future, and then to be able to engage with the world around them in a more productive way.
Anxiety about a coming radio show or a public speaking engagement is not something that is irrational.
Well, and that's a perfect example. And so I'll use myself as an example. I mean, I wake up this morning. I know I'm on the show. Last night, I made sure to go to bed at a reasonable time. I was a little anxious about being on the show today. I've been told I have a good radio face, but I don't believe it.
Believe it.
So, little anxious, not my usual course of activity, get a good night's sleep. Then I went to have coffee with my buddies and joked with them a bit. Ate some good breakfast.
Get your mind off of it.
Yeah, and then read. Prepared myself for the topics that we're going to discuss today. And also took a short walk just to be out in nature, get some fresh air, and then came here. So productive things. Alternative strategies that don't work real well would be get drunk, wake up with a hangover, or use some other drug to somehow or other try to intervene. And it's like, no, just do, don't build up a bunch of craziness in your head about what might happen. Just live in the moment. Do the appropriate things to prepare.
I said to a client once, the best way to make sure that you hang on to your anxiety is to practice it. Right? Keep practicing that anxiety and you will strengthen it. It will get stronger. Okay, we are at the half-hour mark, so we're going to go ahead and take our break. I want to remind folks that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Our topic today is the human brain, how it works, how to keep it going strong into the later years. That's what we'll sort of explore in part when we come back. If you want to participate, our local number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and remember our email at line1, or our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Paul Craig. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Anchorage neuropsychologist Dr. Paul Craig. Our topic is the human brain, how it works, what can go wrong, and how to keep it healthy. I want to remind listeners that Dr. Woodard will continue to host our show 3 Mondays each month, and I will host a show the last Monday of every month on a topic pertaining to emotional and mental health. Remember, you can email questions or comments about today's topic to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call Oakley at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 9. So if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a tape recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. But speaking of phone calls, we have Caroline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Before I get to my political question, I wanted to ask something for confirmation. When I first heard about cortisol, the stress chemical that causes the body to pack in the fat, it seemed reasonable to me because if you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you don't know when you're going to get to slow down for the next meal. And I just wondered if that was something they'd done any research on. But my main question is there a nation that we can compare ourselves to that deals more effectively, immediately with mental health issues? Because people always talk about what things cost, but I don't see much in the leadership about talking about the opportunity cost. What does it cost us later for not dealing with something sooner?
That's a great question. And one that's probably worth a whole show. Dr. Craig, you got any any initial ideas?
Well, I don't have any scientific evidence, but I do have some quick thoughts. One is that if you look at the United States today, we're the most incarcerated country in the world. About 1 out of 100 Americans are behind bars. If you look back to the 70s, when the community mental health system was alive and well and well-funded nationally, we dealt with emotional and behavioral and substance abuse issues as frontline issues. Today, unfortunately, a lot of these issues are being dealt with as criminal issues. And the biggest psychiatric hospital in the United States is the Los Angeles jail. So I do think that from a public policy perspective, it's incumbent upon us to think about how do we best use our financial resources for purposes of addressing primary problems. Proving up on mental health being more cost-effective than corrections is a pretty tough nut to crack. But personally, I believe the humane approach and the most direct approach to the primary underlying problem is typically more productive than just the punitive approach. But that's my belief, not science.
Yeah, I hope that starts to touch on your question, Caroline. It's a good question with a lot of ins and outs.
Yeah, it certainly does. But again, I think that how you appeal to people, those in leadership certainly, is you go down to the dollars and cents. That seems to be what drives the decisions. Thank you. Thank you for the program.
Thanks, Caroline. I will also add that, yes, the criminalization of mental health problems, particularly substance abuse disorders, so much of our folks that are incarcerated are dealing with substance abuse problems or perhaps fetal alcohol, Asperger's. I mean, the population is really, really quite saturated with mental health and substance abuse disorders, and it is untreated. And I think long-term costs, as Caroline pointed out, long-term costs for incarcerating over and over and over again might be mitigated with some treatment. We have them captive, so to speak, as an audience, so it's a great time to implement some of that stuff. We have another caller. I think it's Yosef. I hope I said that right, on cerebral brain hemorrhage.
That's correct.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Excuse me. Just a minute, please.
I caught you eating, huh?
No, I thought I might have to wait for a while. So I'm going to put it on. So my wife, it's actually something about my wife. So hang on a minute. I put you on the speaker. Are you there?
Yes.
All right.
Hello.
Well, maybe I better do this here. She had a cerebral hemorrhage 28 months ago. And she's come a long way. It's long-term memory is perfect again. It's the short-term memory that we're not making the progress that we should. She has recognition problems, vomiting. What else you got? Sleeping too much. Et cetera, et cetera. They put a shunt in there, but we don't seem to make any progress on the short-term end.
Okay, so your question is?
What can we do to bring her back to normal?
After 28 months, Dr. Craig, what are your thoughts on that after a cerebral brain hemorrhage?
Well, first of all, Joseph, is that your name?
Joseph.
Yeah.
Joseph. First of all, one of the things you're doing already is one of the most important things to do, and that is to be a loving husband to your wife and support for somebody who's gone through a disabling condition like a brain hemorrhage is extraordinarily important. How well your wife is doing today is probably in large part due to your support of her through the last couple of years.
I'm a 24/7 caregiver.
Yeah.
The thing is, I'm 81 years old, and I've got a few aches and pains myself.
Yeah, my heart goes out to you. It's a tough role to fill. With regard to the specific issues, I would recommend that you speak with your physician or her physician, and it may or may not warrant neuropsychological testing, but certainly there may be some help that could be provided by way of occupational therapy and or speech and language therapy services. A lot of times, especially when you're talking about 28 months after a cerebral hemorrhage, spontaneous recovery cannot be expected. It really becomes a matter of managing the persisting issues.
I want to give you a little bit more information. Now, she has days where she's really, everything is just working perfect. She recognizes me, we can talk, or we go out and she has conversation with other people. Nothing will indicate that she had a problem. You know, and then we have another day where things are just turning the opposite. Now, to give you an example, she was watching Jeopardy the other day, and she could answer the question faster before these guys could push the button. A minute later, she says, "Who are you?" I am not Joseph. No, you're not. It drives you, you know what, crazy. It's a real problem.
Yeah, and I don't have a magical answer for you. What I would say is, just like you and me, she has good days and bad days. When we've had an insult to the brain, like a cerebral hemorrhage can cause, then our reserves to deal with the bad days or bad moments are impaired. And so
High blood pressure is a problem, you see.
Yeah.
It was the high blood pressure that brought it on in the first place.
And there you're...
When it went over 200, way over 200.
And there, it's very much a medical issue, not a neuropsychological issue, and very important to work with your healthcare provider, your medical provider.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
Of course, she takes, I don't know, twice a day, a ton of medication, but I guess she has to.
And Joseph, in the elderly folks, and in people with some sort of brain stuff going on, medications can cause confusion, lack of sleep. Infections, all sorts of things can have impact, big impact.
She's 71.
So, yeah, see your doctor, discuss. I mean, those supports are so important for you and the social supports. So we appreciate your phone call, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
That's a tough one. I appreciate the call, Joseph, and hang in there. And as Dr. Craig said, keep loving her and helping her through this.
And one other thing I would add, very quickly, Prentice, is that there are a lot of community supports out there. The Alzheimer's Resource Agency, it's not
yes.
just for Alzheimer's, for individuals experiencing or living with somebody who's got a neurological condition interfering with their thinking. They have lots of resources available. And support for caretakers is as important
as
support
care, for
the patient.
In-home supports.
Exactly.
There's all sorts of home health agencies that can come in and provide some respite care for people. Because as a provider, I remember taking care of my grandfather with Alzheimer's. It's super taxing. And as an 18-year-old boy, I took care of him for a summer, and it was brutal. It was super taxing to try to maintain and keep up with that level of confusion and intensity all the time. So,
and imagine being 81.
Yeah, find somebody to provide those supports. Okay, so we're going to skip along here. Well, it looks like we have another call, so we're just going to keep on rolling with these calls. If it's okay, maybe it's – oh, no, we don't have one, but we'll get back to it. Let's go ahead and move forward. We were going to talk about traumatic brain injuries and CTE, but I don't know. We're going to run out of time with that. So I really want to talk about brain health moving into the later years. So discuss some of the brain changes, the normal brain changes that come along as we age, and what's expected normal aging versus abnormal, I guess, for lack of a better term, brain changes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. Let me make one summary statement, though, before we do, about mild traumatic brain injury. There's been a huge amount of media attention to mild traumatic brain injury and CTE in the recent past. And there are a lot of variables at play, only one of which is science. And the science regarding this topic is much more limited than the media hype regarding it. And I certainly would not want to dismiss mild traumatic brain injury as a innocuous, meaningless issue. Likewise, it is very important for, in the case of our youth, that if somebody's involved in an activity in which they get a mild traumatic brain injury or a concussion, it's important that they be pulled out of that activity and protected. But it's also important that they be, as quickly as possible, reactivated. There's this sort of belief that's evolved recently that you've got to put people on complete cognitive rest, complete physical rest for God knows how long. And I don't think that's good. I don't think this, you know, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months of inactivity and disengagement does anybody any good. It sounds like solitary confinement to me. It's punishment. So we need to really be aware what's driven by science, what's driven by media, and then really attend to what's in the best interest of individuals who have been injured. I'll stop that and move on to your question, and that is the normal brain. With aging, I'm 61, and with aging, certain predictable things happen with our mental abilities. Some of them positive, some of them not so positive. Right. Our speed of information processing does go down. My vision has gone down with aging. I'm wearing glasses. I didn't when I was 40. How quickly I can process information and respond is not quite as fast as it was when I was younger. Certain aspects of memory don't function quite as well with normal aging as they do when you're younger. Thankfully, there are some positive twists to aging, like not taking everything quite as seriously as I did when I was 40. Wisdom emerges with aging, where you can see things from multiple perspectives. You also can do better pattern analysis, where you kind of anticipate what's going to happen next and don't swing at every pitch. Let some things unfold naturally. You don't have to intervene, and just don't make little deals into big deals.
Well, my mother, that feeds right into an article my mother sent me last week called Why Elders Smile. She didn't even know I was doing the show, and she sent it to me. I forward it to you, and it's up on our website at alaskapublic.org. Why Elders Smile. Can you talk a little bit about that article and why elders are happier than the rest of us?
There was a psychiatrist named Eric Erickson who talked about the stages of psychological, emotional development. And the final stage during the senior years was called life review versus despair. And we've all seen people who are still mentally intact, but just feel like they missed the boat entirely. They're not telling the stories from their past in a pleasant, you know, enjoyable way.
Bitter, angry, like.
Exactly. Yeah. And then but thankfully, many of us, I like to include myself in this category, with aging, start smiling more, not taking the little deals too seriously, seeing things more abstractly, being able to see things from other people's perspectives.
Perspective.
Yeah. And also, again, pattern analysis, knowing what to expect next based upon prior experience. Mm-hmm. And by way of understanding what's happening around you and anticipating what's going to happen next, it's much easier to step back and let it just happen as opposed to getting all excited about it and worried about it.
All right. I got one. I want to take one more call. We're getting up against it, and we got a lot of stuff to cover. But Dave, you're on the air with Dr. Craig.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Craig. My question concerns borderline personality disorder. My niece has been diagnosed as having that. And how does it differ than bipolar personality disorder? And she's has and how does it interact with such things as substance abuse, which she's involved with, and some of her extremist action has recently run her afoul of the law. So if you could say something about that, I sure would appreciate it. And thanks.
I'm going to keep my answer really brief. I'm not really here to talk about personality disorders, but by definition, personality disorders are considered to be characterologic, longstanding. They should not be used before as a label before 18 years of age. And I am personally very reluctant to use such labels. They're sometimes appropriate, but thrown around a little loosely by some people. And whereas like bipolar disorder, as you mentioned, is more of a psychiatric condition. It's more of a transient condition as opposed to the warp and weft of character that you bring to every aspect of life. And so I don't have much more to say about that, but true personality disorders can be very, very, very difficult to deal with and very debilitating. There are some specialty programs in the University of Washington I'm aware of that use what's called dialectic therapy.
DBT.
Yeah, and can be helpful in terms of intervening with those kind of conditions.
But dialectical behavioral therapy.
Thank you.
yes, Dave, that is just to piggyback on what Dr. Craig said, is personality disorders are deeply ingrained character disorders that are from childhood on up and into adulthood, and they cannot, I do not believe, be accurately diagnosed before the brain is formed, which now we're figuring out is in the late 20s, right? The mid to late 20s. And so depending on how old your daughter is, if she's got that diagnosis from an earlier age and there's substance abuse on board, I might consider getting a second opinion if that's helpful. I don't know how old she is, but that's something to think about.
Well, thanks a lot. She's 30 years old, but we will think about that. And she is down in Seattle, so maybe University of Washington can help us out. And I sure appreciate your thoughts.
Okay, Dave. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Yeah, personality disorders are another show, which would be that would be interesting.
Or multiple shows.
Multiple shows. And so are TBIs and CTEs. I think maybe we should come back, get you back and do another one. So in aging, let's talk real briefly because we're getting on with our time. But what can people do? What are the best things? And we hear those ads about Lumosity and some of those brain game things, sign up and get your brain going in the right direction right now. Is that a thing, or are there other things that are much more important in keeping the aging brain healthy?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a bit of a skeptic, and I don't watch television because I know what advertising is about, and the
right.
best psychologists work for advertising firms changing our behavior. I prefer to think for myself. And there is a huge advertising budget right now for cognitive rehabilitation online, and there is no harm associated with exercising your brain. In fact, there's a body of research to suggest that brain exercises can be useful, but I think need to be really cautious about over-interpreting those data. If a person is actually suffering from the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, for example,
right.
cognitive exercises on one of these online programs will not alter that. It'd probably be much more helpful to do some of the things like I was mentioning to Joseph previously, and that would be to set up the house so that functioning is optimized, use memory aids, use other things that have been proven to be
environmental adaptation.
An intelligent environment, exactly, to help a person adapt to their environment better.
Okay, so what about a 48-year-old guy who's worried about his brain, like I am, and what would I do? What are some quick pointers on what do I do to keep it healthy into my 70s, barring any Alzheimer's or traumatic event?
Well, okay, first of all, in terms of neuropsychological evaluation, if you can worry about it, call me up, schedule an appointment, and keep that appointment. You probably don't need the appointment.
All right.
But my point is that, you know, most of us are among the worried well. And the what you can do to keep your brain optimally functioning is stay healthy and stay engaged and stay mentally active. Stay physically active, socially active, mentally active. There was a study done with Chicago executives who were who had retired, and this is done many years ago, and the data continues to be supported. One of the best measures of maintaining cognitive functioning was vital capacity. How much air can you breathe in and out of your lungs?
Huh.
And your good cardiovascular condition, don't have diabetes, keep a sense of humor, keep some love in your life in the broad context, and keep yourself socially engaged. And mental activity is good, but if you're doing mental activity like one of these online programs in perpetuity at the expense of getting out and taking a walk or exercising or taking a bike ride or whatever it may be, that's not good.
So don't sit in your bedroom and do Sudoku and crossword puzzles and look at Lumosity.
You can do that for a while. But
and then go talk to a friend and get out and go for a walk and engage with people that you care about and build relationships. That's what keeps us young is what you're saying cognitively.
That's right.
Okay. We are about it. You got like 30 seconds to give us something lasting. I think we just did that.
Well, I'll give you a quote from my dad. And he said, I want to die young at a very old age. Take good care of yourself and in all ways, and the likelihood of that will be increased.
Great. My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Paul Craig. If you would like to continue today's conversation, join KSK on Facebook. You can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, Dr. Woodard returns. His guest will be Eula Biss, author of On Immunity and Inoculation. Her book was selected as one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 Best Books of 2014. So why not tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, December 22nd at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 9 on 91.1 KSKA Anchorage. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Please remember that you can podcast today's show along with all the other KSK's other great local programming by going to alaskapublic.org. Just click on the link to your favorite program. Thanks for listening. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and as my daughter Marin said last night, have a great brain.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.